Our help is in the name of the Lord.
Amen.
Our first hymn is in the inside of, does everyone have a booklet? Okay. And our first hymn is Come Down, O Love Divine. And maybe we could all stand.
Come down, O love divine, seat thou this soul of mine, and visit it with thine own ardor glory. O Comforter, draw near, within my heart appear, and kindle it, thy holy flame bestowing. O let it
this month is on Philip's patience. And can everyone hear me? Am I ready to speak? Okay. And so I couldn't find anything in the School of St. Philip book on his patience that would have enough material that I thought could cover. But I found a lot of material in Father Bocci's Life of St. Philip Neri. And I actually did remove a lot from this, and I still have too much, I think. So I don't think we're going to get through all of this, but you're welcome to keep the book if you want for your own personal reflection. I have like an obsessive fear of running out of information in like 20 minutes, and so I put way too much in here. But it's all really good too. So because of that, though, we don't have an introduction, and we're just not going to have a separate reading, so we'll just dive right in and see what happens. Okay. And please, if anything strikes you, please, as always, bring it up, and just whatever, you think is good. We now come to the virtue with which the saints hold to be the touchstone of all sanctity, and that is patience. We may say that St. Philip's whole life, besides being one continuous act of mortification, was also one unbroken exercise of patience because of the contradictions that he met with in everything that he did. First of all, he was the butt and laughingstock of the courtiers in almost every palace. They said everything bad of him which came into their mind, especially while he was living at San Girolamo, so that as soon as any of his penitents appeared at court, he was asked what Padre Messer Filippo was doing and what dainty he had eaten that morning. How many
capons
had been presented to him, and how many pipkins his spiritual children had sent him, with other similar pieces of disrespect and impertinence. And this sarcastic talk lasted for years and years, so that Rome was full of it, and through all the shops and banks, the idiots and scapegraces did little else but ridicule Philip for his penitence. All this was, of course, known to the saint, and everyone was astonished, not only at his patience, but at the great joy he evinced in hearing that he was ridiculed in this manner. A person of quality who used himself to make game of him, reflecting upon this unwearied patience, conceived such an esteem for him that he sent continually to recommend himself to his prayers. And wherever Philip was the subject of conversation, he extolled his goodness as something wonderful. So, it kind of struck me there, maybe Philip's response to all the ridicule being, his response being great joy, like that he took great joy in it, I guess you would think he would perhaps be either concerned that there was some truth to that and wondering what that might be, or that might be his response, or his response might be one of anger at ridicule, but his response is joy. So that just kind of struck me. Yes?
What is a pipkin and a cup?
I don't know how to say it. It sounds like some kind of dessert. Like the first word was dainty, and so it seems like some kind of dessert. No? Yeah.
What strikes me with just in the first page was when I was printing these and I was reading the first, at first I was thinking, you know, in light of 500 years later, we can kind of look back and wonder like how all these people would be making fun of Philip and all of these things. But reading it just now, what really kind of struck me is that Philip couldn't see us now, you know, with like oratories all over the world, and that it was like obviously blessed and a holy, godly thing. And so it's really remarkable putting him in the place of, there are no oratories, there's no success yet, he's just like an upstart layman turned priest, that the kind of patience and determination and like discernment he would have had to know that he was doing God's will, even though like everyone around him, especially when he ends up being like silenced and not being allowed to even practice. It's kind of a curious thing, because some saints in building their orders met with a lot of welcome. So kind of wonder like, how would Philip have discerned that he wasn't doing the wrong thing because everyone hated him?
Yeah.
It almost seems to me as if Philip had a following, and that he had lots of people who did admire him. He had spiritual children that certainly went to confession to him, that highly valued his counsel, you know, cardinals and, you know, other religious and lots of other folks. And that he almost saw this, you know, sarcastic mockery of his popularity as a good counterbalance for himself, so that he remembered that none of that glory or that adulation that maybe sometimes was directed at him, you know, by admiring disciples, was ultimately really directed at him, but that he was sort of the, you know, whatever you want to say, the earthen vessel that carried this great, you know, richness. And so for that reason, you know, he thought that, you know, he was joyful fun of him and deriding him, mm-hmm. because it helped him to maintain his own interior, you know, humility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and then maybe that was the reason why he was able to respond in that way, despite not seeing the future of the oratory, that it would spread, that his focus was on the virtue itself, on and the fruit of that, of being ridiculed and everything that bore the fruit of patience and humility, and that everything else that came later that he couldn't see was maybe a fruit of is simply paying attention to the growth and the virtue itself. There were some who, out of a spirit of jealousy, or for other reasons of their own, could not bear to see the exercises of the oratory prospering, or the odor of Philip's sanctity daily spreading far and wide. These persons laid hold of every occasion they could to breed in others a bad opinion of him. One day there was a cry all through Rome that Father Philip of San Girolamo had been put in prison for improper intercourse with women, the fact being that a servant living there, and also named Philip, had been imprisoned for that cause. But the envious, making use of the equivoque of the name, went about fastening this rumor on the saint. When Philip heard of it, he did not take it in the least amiss, but with the greatest calmness contented himself with a simple smile. And I guess I just kept that paragraph in there so we could see on kind of the degree to which the ridicule went that he was facing, that it wasn't merely being made fun of or sarcastic. It was not just limited to, you know, sarcastic jokes about dainties and things, but these are actually that's actually a very serious charge, and that even that he responds with a smile. And I guess my first thought with that was kind of wondering, you know, should he have maybe just for the sake of scandal, like, defended himself, but he doesn't, and, you know, maybe, I don't know, if he thought, you know, the fact that he actually wasn't in prison was enough reason, but.
Well, it's interesting, his reaction is different. That kind of struck me when it said, like, he contented himself with a simple smile, and, like, in the previous, when they're just making, like, stupid jokes and being impertinent, it says, and everyone was astonished not only at his patience, but at the great joy he evinced in hearing. And so I thought it was interesting that in that, which is really harmless to his reputation and sort of sense of, like, scandal, he can be really joyful in it. But in this one, it's like a patient endurance, but he's certainly not like, oh, yay, they think I did a terrible, terrible thing. So it's interesting because it's not like there's not a lack of discretion in his reaction. Mm-hmm. Like, there's something obviously much more serious about Philip just kind of smiling and walking away.
Yes?
Because he's so sure of himself and in his relationship with God that he knows he's not done anything, and God will take care of whatever happens, and any trials that he has to go through can be united with the cross.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know that much about him, so I don't know. That just was my take on that. How could you be so calm?
Yeah, that his concern is so greatly about what God is thinking of him, that his reputation is, in the eyes of people, is that unimportant to him, that he's able to.
Right, yeah.
He might have been also pleased that God had so narrowed the way for him to go. Because actually I had a job one time where it was, and it was miserable. I had to keep my head down, and that was all I could do, and keep doing what I knew was right. It was very rarely rewarding. I just had to keep going. None of it being my fault, none of it, you know, because I was not doing the job I was supposed to be doing. So, I mean, and it's a way of, you know, it just narrows your options. You know, you can really only come up with one right thing, please God. And not be concerned about anything else that's going on. It makes things simpler.
When we read this, it's kind of interesting to me how often God uses this specific circumstance in the lives of the saints. The other saint that I'm calling to mind is Saint Gerard Majella, who also had to deal with this until the person confessed that it wasn't him. And he went through years and years of public humiliation for this. So the patience that saints have to deal with even this particular sin and being accused of it is remarkable. It just kind of, it's something to just take note of and to just think about. I'm sure someone else could think of another saint too, but I feel like there's at least a couple more. But I'm finding it interesting that he was accused of this as well.
It seems like a lot of saints too have undergone some sort of public humiliation that if it was me undergoing, I would be like so bad. If this happened to me, I'd be like wanting to hire the best attorney and like go cleanse my name. Or like Newman. I mean, Newman had all, you know, he's a prolific author and oratorian. And Cardinal Manning and Cardinal Wiseman just like basically spread that he was just a total liberal, didn't follow church teaching, and they like tried to hide from him that the Pope wanted to make him a cardinal. And so he regarded himself as like a total intellectual failure. And so he went from being like an Oxford man at the top of the totem pole, everyone thought he was this genius 25-year-old guy, and by the time he was 50, he just regarded himself as like, I've borne no fruit intellectually for anyone. And we know now that that's not the case. But if I was him, I'd be like out aggressively defending myself as like the Oxford genius that I was. Which I'm clearly not. And that's primarily probably the reason why. But it just seems like all of them sort of undergo these like really, really difficult trials.
Yeah.
But the fact that he wasn't in prison,
but
the people kind of know.
I think that was like, that's what was satisfying to me, to like say, well, maybe they just said, you know, well, he's clearly not the same guy because he's not in prison. But I don't think that was actually the underlying. But yeah, but I found that helpful.
Yeah. And if you think too about like the whole priest child abuse crisis.
Yeah.
A lot of those guys never ended up in prison, but their name and reputation were still absolutely destroyed. And some of them couldn't even practice their priesthood anymore.
Right.
Even though the FBI, for example, couldn't find enough evidence to send them to prison.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I wonder if the motivation for his patience is motivated not just out of a willingness to suffer for God, but kind of like the pray for your persecutors thing, that if he's being more mindful of those who are taunting him and their, you know, spiritual well-being, you know, like obviously he's not going to be joyful at someone else's sinfulness or peril of their salvation, or, you know, if his attention is more on the other people than just on what he has to endure, and that, you know, the saints do that better than we do, for example.
Yeah.
You know, we're thinking of ourselves and justice and, you know, but that would come at the expense of, you know, confronting those people instead of whatever, working or praying or offering it up for their enlightenment or their, you know, spiritual progress or whatever.
That it wouldn't just be him saying, what a great opportunity this is to really, I can become, you know, a champion at patience. And but actually, like, he has another, one of Philip's maxims is, that I kind of like is, he says that we should not only forgive those who persecute us, but have pity for the delusion that they're laboring under. And so, like, the focus isn't just on how much grace or merit can I attain through going through this, but actually being concerned with the other person who is also made in the image of God, and people made in the image of God, you know, shouldn't do that kind of thing, but that, so that it's kind of, I think that's true, like, the focus isn't just on himself and his own personal growth, but.
Yeah, so he's basically saying his reputation is less important than his concern for their salvation or you know, well-being, whatever. Yeah.
Something similar occurred in the church of San Giovanni de Fiorentini, where a gentleman servant began without any cause to insult Philip with manner and language so insolent that Fabrino Mantichetti, a canon of St. Peter's and a man of note in the literary world, not being able to endure even to witness such impertinence, was about to lay hands on him. But seeing, on the other hand, the gentleness and joy with which the Holy Father took it all, he restrained himself and was so edified with that exhibition of patience that from that day forward he honored Philip as a saint. Another time, as he was out walking with some of his spiritual children, he met a cardinal who had given ear to false and sinister reports against him. So strongly was he prejudiced against Philip that as soon as he saw him, he ordered the carriage to stop and gave him a most bitter reprimand in public. The saint, knowing the rectitude of the cardinal's intention, was not in the least disturbed, but with his usual smile went up to him and whispered a few words in his ear. The countenance of the cardinal changed instantly, and showing the Holy Father great remarks of kindness, he said, "Go on then doing what you are doing now."
Everyone just wants to know what he said.
Yeah. There are no footnotes or anything on that. But it was not strangers only who furnished Philip with occasions of exercising his patience. His own spiritual children, and even those under the greatest obligation to him, contributed by their behavior to his perfection in this respect. Some of them, not being in the least able to enter into his real character, thought him a coarse and foolish simple person, and treated him accordingly, without his showing the least resentment, or his kind looks being altered towards them. When an important affair regarding the congregation was under discussion, a letter upon the subject was presented to the Holy Father as superior, and while he was reading it, one present, thinking the letter contained something which he did not want Philip to know, insolently snatched it out of his hand, saying that it was not to be read. The saint took the affront with such incomparable meekness that neither his look, word, or gesture betrayed the slightest internal emotion. But a long time afterwards, he gave orders to Father Germanico Fedeli that after his death, the offender should be corrected, in order that, by acknowledging his error and doing penance for it, he might obtain pardon and indulgence of God.
So, what do you think about like the duty to remove people from their sort of ignorance, as opposed to just suffering their mistakes? Like these people are clearly mistaken about stuff, and you're sort of letting them live in their own mistaken views of reality.
Yeah. I think. Like in this case, I remember we went over this example. I remember in our novice meetings, the guy who just snatches the thing out of Philip's hand. I would think that there's often a complexity to the reasons why people would be like this, especially. Like not just their inability to enter his real character, but treating him that way, like in a way that, so like they're in error and it's unjust what they're doing, but often I think, and I've heard, you know, some of the other priests say, and I think it's good counsel that often God will correct those kinds of things in his time, and that because of the complexity of the reasons behind them that we aren't often aware of, our attempts to correct those kinds of things often undermine kinds of healing that God might already have. He might already be in the process of that we're not aware of, that maybe St. Philip's not doing anything but remaining, like not betraying any resentment or anything to that person, impacted the person in a way that he himself didn't realize, but was maybe part of a deeper process that God was working out. And that if St. Philip had turned on him, or corrected him there, then he might have just been showing himself to be no different than anyone else who would have wanted to show him that he was wrong. Because that's kind of our tendency, is to want to put people in the, want to show people, like, you know, that, well, I was even thinking of, in the Bible, when St. Paul corrects St. Peter, and I was talking to someone about this recently, like that he says, well, it's about the Judaizers, and St. Paul says, at that point, I confronted Peter to his face because he was clearly in the wrong. And I thought, that's like, that's inspired by the Holy Spirit. It's like, even. But I think, you know, that's an I'm getting off track. That's like where you see even the saints aren't perfect, like even the apostle. But that's, I think, like our response is to say, you know, our tendency is to say, I'm going to fix this guy, and I'll say it's because he's in error and I can show him the light. But really, it's maybe that's injured my pride, and I need to make myself feel better. I'm sure maybe it's a combination of that, but that in ways like we don't see at the time, God might work on it. And I think it seems like Philip saw that to such a degree that he even told this other priest to, but after Philip died, then correct him. Like, so he is acknowledging the need for this guy to be corrected, but maybe to keep from from Philip intervening in God's work, he thought the best way would be to wait until he's dead, and then he can take no satisfaction in. That's what I think.
I think this this example is really interesting. In fact, because this whole section is paralleling something we just finished studying in the Ancient Christian Writers Group. I know you listened to the podcasts. And there ended up being in this one conference a lot of talk about patience. And as we've been taught a lot of times, Philip read Cassian so much and based almost everything on what he read in the conferences. And there was just an example of a young monk who someone else in their envy of his holiness planted false evidence in his cell and said he stole a book and, you know, all of this stuff. Anyway, so the young monk is completely disgraced and he's pretty much going to lose everything. And he just accepts it all, and then he begs forgiveness and goes into penance for this sin he never committed, and it goes on for a pretty long time. And the one who actually planted the evidence is really interesting how it ended up happening, because he sees the holy monk doing all of this terrible penance for the sin he never committed, and so he is repentant. But the demon that's sort of taken up residence in him can't even be cast out by the elders of the community, because it's too raging, and only the holy monk who he offended was able to exorcise the demon. And it's really cool, but I would imagine that when things like this happen, Philip had to be thinking of those things, just like he read. And when we were reading that in class, it's uncomfortable, because just like Brother Reed was saying, like, if someone accused me of stealing something and I would lose my job and my home and like, I would completely freak out. Like, I couldn't even imagine where it would be a virtue to allow myself to go to prison and, like, serve a sentence and lose everything for that. But as uncomfortable as it makes us, a lot of the saints did do that. And I think it is really hard to accept, probably for very good reason, that, like, temporally your entire life can be changed, and not necessarily for the better, but there has to be something in that. Mm-hmm. I just hope no one ever does that, because I don't want to be tested with that. I'll lose.
To follow up on that point, in that same discussion, there was another example about a young monk. He was a different young monk, but he was at dinner at a large gathering, and his superior walked up and slapped him in the face.
Yeah.
And right, the language there was almost exactly the same as this, which
you could hear it from across the room.
Right. There was no change in his countenance.
Mm.
Right. And so it just never for a moment did anger seem to cross his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember reading that because I was driving home on Route 28. And, and so that moment of road rage that I experience frequently while driving over 28, I'm better than I was when I was in my 20s, and so in 10, 20 seconds I can relax and I'll forgive them before I get home. But right, that instantaneous forgiveness, that in the moment of being insulted, you already have forgiveness and mercy.
Mm.
It's a fascinating example of sort of being connected without having it be something that you work at and you know that you should and you wait for the adrenaline to go away and then you can find it. Right? But that's sort of being so formed that you have it in the moment, almost anticipating it without any attempt to stop it.
Yeah.
It's pretty fascinating.
And as you said, the language is almost parallel. And one of the interesting parallels, and I didn't think of it until you just said that, was that in both cases it says at least one person, but I'm guessing multiple others too, were so edified by by the example of patience that there was a major conversion in their life. And in the case of that young monk being like, probably had an enormous welt on the side of his face for days, all of these visiting monks and probably all of his brothers had this incredible experience of witnessing perfect patience and being edified by it. And you would imagine that the same thing was the case here, that his accepting the abuse of one person served the holiness of all the others. Cool.
He carried this virtue of patience so far that he not only bore with his persecutors, but even loved them tenderly. He was not contented with praying for them himself and at his ease, but for that end, he went often to St. Peter's or to Vespontina Vecchia, possibly Santa Maria del Carmine. He made his penitents pray for them, often giving them an obedience to say a pater and an ave for his persecutors. Indeed, patience had so completely become a habit with him that he was never seen in a passion, and it appeared as though he did not even know how to be angry. As soon as ever the first movement of resentful feeling rose within him, he checked it at that moment, and doing violence to himself, his countenance calmed instantly and reassumed his usual modest smile. I think this kind of gets to what you were saying about, like you said, it seems like he almost anticipated. And here it says, like, he, as soon as the first movement of resentful feeling rose within him, he checked it at that moment. And I think that kind of attests to how kind of how deep Philip's prayer life was, that he was so aware of what was going on within him all the time, that he could see as soon as something that was like that was coming, that what the response was going to be, and that he didn't want to go down that path, like he didn't want to allow resentment to get a foothold, or and that he could see the moment where he could make the choice, I can choose to justly be angry and resentful of this person, or I could choose to do what Christ would do and suffer for it, and I guess not just suffer for it, but choose to love the other person, like he instead, he says, he not only bore with his persecutors, but even loved them tenderly, but he make the choice could be either to give in to resentment and feel justified in doing so, or to choose to love the person who's persecuting him. Yeah, I think because of the depth of his prayer, like, he was able to be aware of that and make that choice when it, in instances like that.
He even doesn't try to be capable of praying for them by himself.
Yeah.
He's going to let it out that this is something that he needs help.
Yeah.
Praying.
By himself. Yeah. Which is, yeah. I hadn't thought of that. So it's like exercising humility in that aspect too, that it's not as though he's simply relying on the strength of his own prayer life, but acknowledging that he's as subject to, anger or resentment as anyone, and needs help.
Yeah, his time in his practice of the sacrament of reconciliation is almost higher than the other sacrament in a way.
Yeah.
He's so into. I've only read two of his biographies, but then mm-hmm. It seems like that was his big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of thought that line was reassuring, like, oh, well, at least he was capable of resentful feelings.
Yeah.
I wasn't
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. Yeah. At least he had to reassume his usual mind.
Exactly. It's like, oh, he almost lost yeah. it.
I guess he's saint that way. No one ever saw Philip melancholy. Those who went to him always found him with a cheerful and smiling countenance, yet mixed with gravity. And this was so well known among his disciples that they used to say, "You may say or do what you would like to Father Philip, and insult him as you please, for you cannot put him out of temper." Once he was told that some people had called him a silly old fellow, and he was greatly pleased with it. Another time he heard that a religious had said of him that he was doting, and it put him into such good spirits that he told Cardinal Cusano of it with immense glee, and sending for the religious, caressed him with marks of the warmest affection. Again, when he was told that people thought him mad for carrying a dog about in his arms through the streets of Rome, he laughed and was highly delighted. And another time when he was told that people had been preaching publicly against the Institute of the Oratory, he did not answer a word or betray the least emotion. Philip exhibited an equally edifying patience in the sicknesses which he had almost every year, brought on by his over-fatiguing himself, and which often lasted 50 or 60 days at a time. He received extreme unction 4 times, and even then he had the same calm and joyous countenance. Once when the physicians had given him over, and he saw that all around him were much cast down at the idea of his death, he said with a firm voice and quiet courage, "I am ready, and am not troubled." He never spoke of his illness except to the medical men, and he never showed outwardly what he suffered, however sharp it might be, and when he spoke, it was to break out into such exclamations as those, "My Lord, if you wish for me, behold, here I am. My love, I have not known you. I have not done any good." And while he said this, he used to shed tears. He always heard the confessions of his penitents, unless the physicians expressly forbade him to do so. And if those in the house begged him not to do so, because of his illness, he told them to let him alone, for hearing confessions was a recreation to him, so great was his zeal for the salvation of others. He was never heard to change his voice, as invalids generally do, but he spoke in the same sonorous tone as when he was well. When he was ill, he did not so much receive consolation from his visitors as impart consolation to them. And by the various winning ways in which he dealt with them, it always turned out that the charity was rather on his side than on theirs.
To accept quite different humiliations not brought on by himself.
Mm-hmm.
So carrying dog through the streets and people making fun of it, he did that to himself. Which is probably why he thought it was funny. Anyway, but it would, like, it, I'm really seeing how it prepared him over the course of his life. To handle and to really deal with and be discreet, like even about his illness, like it really helped him to just be silent and suffered in silence, as opposed to doing what I would do, be like, oh, I have a headache today, and everybody would know it. It's kind of, you could say it's even edifying now to read about it.
Yeah, I think that might have been something in the Cashin group also, but also something in I forget, in Philip's life where he talks about like and it's at the end of this as well. I don't know if we'll get to it, but it does talk about like some of his penitents would see him doing things like you were saying, like bringing suffering or some humiliation or something on himself as a way of preparing for other times when it came from outside of him, like outside of his control. And like it'll say in here that he said that's not for everyone, but that for those for whom it was for, like the exercise would be kind of like to imagine like when you're not in that kind of situation of being ridiculed or humiliated, to imagine it, and then
yeah, that came from Cassian this past week, I think.
Okay.
But he definitely did stuff like that as well, and I thought about St. Philip when we read that too.
So I was also struck by that section with Train the Dog. Did Philip ask others to do the same thing? So he did it to himself, but also for some of his penitents, he would have them essentially do humiliating things, right?
Yeah, the dog. The dog, he like became, that became like a central rule for him, I think. And I think a lot of those kinds of things, Philip, there would be self-imposed penances, but then also ones that he would give. Like, I've heard stories of him shaving half his beard, and I've also heard stories of him assigning that as a penance to, like, vain young men of society. And, but also, like, the dog one. Like, he carried the dog around, but then also he would have some of his own disciples carry the dog through the streets. And, in fact, I think one of them, I forget which oratorian in his circle, called the dog the scourge of human minds, because Philip used it so much as a way to humble them. It is a common thing that he would do that, those kinds of things to himself, but then also assign those as penances for others.
I like the dog. When I first heard about the dog like 2 years ago, I was imagining, you know, something cute and kind of fluffy, but like back then dogs were just mangy street animals, so like it was embarrassing because it was a dog, but it was still like a cute little dog. And then I was informed that it was actually like this really big dog that was like dirty and filthy. And so not only was it a dog, but it was like disgusting, and they would have to be like carrying this enormous big dog. And it made it so much better.
I didn't get that either.
Yeah, you just imagine it would carrying size. It wasn't carrying size. It was like. I think he made Cardinal Baronius carry it even when he was cardinal.
Okay.
Right? So there was like a cardinal walking through Rome with this enormous, disgusting dog. It's pretty great.
I think people rejoiced when the dog died.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah.
I don't know why I would.
Yeah.
I've seen an icon of Philip holding this little like Pomeranian.
That's what that's for.
So it gets it wrong. But
yeah. I always just thought there was a weird icon. I never made the connection. That's amazing. Yeah, it's very small. I think fits in the palm of your hand.
Philip not only gave a bright and continual example of patience, but many admonitions and maxims concerning it to his spiritual children. He said that nothing more glorious could happen to a Christian than to suffer for Christ, and that he who really loved God would take no thing so much to heart as the not finding any occasion of suffering for him, because the having no tribulation is the greatest tribulation which can befall a servant of God. When he heard any of his disciples saying that they could not bear such and such adversities, he used to say to them, "Nay, say rather that you are not worthy of so great a good, or that the Lord should visit you, for that there is no sure or clearer argument of the love of God than adversity." When a confessor was once complaining to him that he was unjustly persecuted, Philip reproved him, "How can you teach others patience, who are so impatient yourself? My son, the greatness of our love of God is known by the greatness of our desire to suffer for the love of him." There is nothing, he used to say, which brings about contempt of the world more quickly, or unites the soul to God more closely, than being harassed and afflicted, and that they who are not admitted as scholars to that school may well call themselves unlucky men.
So the question that strikes me when reading that, well, because obviously I think it's really hard to hear, because you don't want your love for God to be measured by your desire to suffer for him. But if you wanted to attempt to imitate that, like, how do you do that in a not self-righteous way, or in a way that, like, objectifies other people? Like, oh, good, my opportunities for growing in virtue, come, be horrible. Like, you wouldn't want to do that, but, like, how do you go about seeking out opportunities to suffer patiently without just becoming kind of self-righteous and obnoxious?
Well, I guess I would say maybe not seeking them out, maybe. I think St. Philip says other words. Some other place, like, not to seek for afflictions because, or not to seek more crosses because we don't know, like, what we're able to bear and what we're not. How do you go about it? So
does he mean more like seeking opportunities to suffer things well in what's already happening in your life, rather than, like, I know if I go to this particular place, this annoying thing will happen, so I'm going to do it on purpose, you know? But, because I think that could be, like, a way where people maybe go too far.
Sure.
Like, instead of anticipating the day and saying, like, where in what is already going to happen that's out of my control,
yeah,
do I seek out these opportunities versus, like, purposefully implanting themselves in the middle of difficult situations?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine people actually doing that, but, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think,
I'm, throughout the reading too, I've been thinking of, most of us know the prayer attributed to St. Francis, making an instrument of peace. There's a prayer called the Litany of Humility, written by a later Franciscan, which is the to-do list for how to reach the lofty aspirations in the prayer attributed to St. Francis. And most people get about halfway through the Litany of Humility and think, oh my goodness, this is all, it's all interior stuff. In other words, Jesus, meek and humble of heart, deliver me from the fear of being ridiculed.
Right. Give me the desire of having others preferred
over
me.
Yeah. That I would be forgotten. And Anyway, but I mean, those are all interior states that would then let you step up to the plate, and when that moment of suffering is given to you, you'd be there with Philip.
Yeah.
Maybe be able to smile.
You know, speaking of like seeking out persecution, it reminds me of like, when St. Francis had went to hope to become a martyr and went to the Sultan, and he didn't end up becoming a martyr, but they sent him back, and like, he was disappointed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I recently heard someone talking about that, about how St. Philip went to, or not St. Philip, St. Francis went to the Sultan, I think it was like Syria, went all the way out to Syria and to try to convert him, and didn't get martyred, and came back, and the person he left in charge while he was gone decided to, it was like two things. One was he decided to build a house, and Francis didn't want there to be a house, so Francis, like, he's a lot like, St. Philip and St. Francis are kind of similar in some ways, and St. Francis, like, in order to try to preserve, like, the ideal of Franciscan poverty, like, climbs up on the roof and starts tearing the shingles out. And then this cardinal comes and says, well, the house belongs to me, not to your order, so you can't do that. So, like, he, that's sidetracked, but, but, yeah. So there are people who, yeah, so I mean, but I think maybe it does kind of show the point, like there are people who would possibly tend toward an extreme of seeking out suffering in a way that, and I think maybe it would come back to the purpose of Christian suffering, that St. Philip says, nothing more glorious could happen to a Christian than to suffer for Christ. And maybe the reason being the same as what, like, we've been seeing, like, all these, his responses to, like, humiliating things and the sarcasm and the accusations is that there's a joining of himself to Christ in that. And so the point of the suffering is the drawing closer to Christ, like an imitation of his suffering, and that Christ didn't, yeah, that Jesus himself didn't seek out the suffering, you know, even said, not my will, but yours be done to God, so like he didn't want to. So even maybe even Christ's own example is he didn't go out seeking ways to show us how to grow in virtue, but the response of love in the situation was such that it brought suffering that could, like in our case, help us to grow in patience, maybe. I don't know if that's
one of the things I was struck at, certainly in the beginning of the readings, was this response of joy.
Yeah.
I understand forbearance and not caring, but joy was hard.
Yeah.
And then so, as you read this, it sort of reminds me that sort of in the Beatitudes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Blessed are they who are persecuted in my name.
Mm-hmm.
It also raises a question, are there times when patience, is it always? Is patience always the right response, right? Or are there times when patience, right, isn't in God's name and therefore wouldn't be the appropriate response?
How do you mean? Like the becoming impatient would be the proper response? Or?
So for an example, let's say that you were accused of something.
Uh-huh.
I have information that I know would probably vindicate you. So
uh-huh.
Perhaps I wouldn't choose to vindicate myself, right? But should I be patient and let it play out? Or should I speak up and vindicate you?
I guess I would say, I guess to me the difference would be the, I might be wrong, it seems like there's a difference in defending oneself and defending another person, that there's something, because our tendency is towards selfishness, and we're more, that we wouldn't have to like stop and think, okay, should I defend this person, or should I, maybe this is what they need in their life, or something like that. Whereas like, if it happens to me, if it happens to me, then it's like, okay, can I be patient with this? Like the response, the initial response is maybe different. And also, even the idea of like giving your own life for someone else, I mean, I think we would say right away that that's different than giving someone else's life away for someone else. That, and so, I guess I can see where that would still be, there could still be like, you still wonder, you know. But I don't know that it would necessarily be the same kind of, I don't know if you could call it patience if it's, I'm going to defend this person. Whereas it would be patience to like take accusation to yourself, that maybe for another person, it seems like, I don't know, it's, maybe I'm wrong about that, it seems like the desire to defend the other person is the, what charity calls for in that situation, whereas in all these situations where Philip is being accused, charity is calling for patience and bearing with it. In fact, like even, yeah, because even Jesus says, like, for those who are, he defends the woman caught in adultery. So I think, the Lord's own example maybe kind of shows the difference. There's something different about, there's something different for a human being defending himself and defending another human being, even if just because of our fallenness, but even it seems like even the nature of God, of being self-giving, like being directed toward the good of the other, there's something about that, even if we weren't sinful, that's different. I don't know.
Well, what you said there at the end, I thought was really interesting, that in all things, it sort of comes back to what is charity asking, and how are you imitating the self-giving of Christ? Because in all of these instances of Philip practicing this patience, there's a good to be effected for his persecutor in him displaying this patience. And so in that, there is a self-sacrifice and there's a self-giving, whereas in the other situation, you know, I guess self-giving would be to help that other person. So that is interesting.
In fact, I guess helping the other person is aligning yourself with the person who's being accused, and aligning yourself with the one who is the object of suffering. So there's kind of like a willingness to experience that person's suffering with them, in order to, just by the fact of defending them. In order to animate his disciples to this virtue of patience, he exhorted them never to lose heart, for it is God's way to make human life a sort of web, first a trouble, then a consolation, at least an interior one. he instructed them never to fly from a cross, for in that case they were sure to light upon a greater one, and that there is nothing on earth more beautiful than to make real virtue of necessity. Instead of doing what men mostly do, manufacture crosses for themselves.
I think that last bit really gets at what we were just talking about, like the, what's the difference of making an opportunity out of an already present thing versus manufacturing crosses, and that his patience really is that just making a real act of virtue out of what necessity demands and what charity demands. That's pretty cool.
He did not, however, advise his penitents to ask tribulations of God in the presumption that they could bear them, but to walk most warily in this matter, for it is not little which a man does when he bears what God sends him daily. Yet he himself, on one occasion, compassionating a poor invalid, abandoned by the physicians, begged of God in the most absolute manner, and with an act of heroic charity, the life of the poor sufferer, desiring that the severe sickness might pass from him upon himself. And his venturous prayer was heard and answered to the letter. So I think this maybe speaks to the question of why, the same question. Some who had been exercised in the service of God for a long time, he recommended to adopt this practice. In the time of prayer, to imagine that all manner of insults and affronts were offered to them, such as blows, wounds, and the like, and then to make acts of charity in imitation of the charity of Christ, and to accustom their hearts to remit injuries in good earnest to those who might offend them. And he said that this exercise would bring with it a great increase of devotion. To one person, however, who begged him to teach him the method of this exercise, he said, "No, it will not do for you, nor for all." I guess maybe what kind of stood out for me in those two paragraphs, they seem to kind of go together, is that, like, Philip, with this practice, like, it's not just some kind of formula or mechanical thing that if you do these things, then you'll become a patient person. Maybe for whatever the reason, the last person who wants to learn how to do that, and he says it's not for him or for all, like, I mean, I would think, especially in the circles that Philip was in, that a person asking him might be in, that could be humbling and possibly, like, discouraging to think, you know, why are these others around me able to do these great acts of penance in order to grow in the virtue of patience, which just seems like a good thing, but it's not for me. That maybe Philip saw something, was able to see things in this person that wouldn't have been helpful, but would have been for others, and that maybe the humility was needed, or whatever that elicited was the thing that was more needed. One of the priest instructors. I haven't come across this quote myself, but one of the priest instructors at the seminary I had in a class last year, we were talking about the vocation to celibacy, and He said that somewhere Saint Padre Pio says that God calls not the best to the life of virginity or celibacy, but the worst. And to all these seminarians turning priests. And I think about that, like I'm that it can be, and there's another, someone brought this up in a homily recently, that there was a priest who also said, like, of Lenten practices, not to compare yourself to others in terms of what you're doing for Lent. He said, his phrase was, compare and despair. And there is, because we can see, like, if we compare ourselves to other people, all we, like, it can be really depressing, because we see the outside, and we see, what great things they might seem to be doing, like this person might see people, you know, Philip's teaching them this really advanced method of preparing one's soul for the opportunity to grow in virtue when actual calamities hit, and he's telling me that that's not for me. And the initial way to take that might be to say, because this person is just so much more advanced than me, and I'm never gonna make any advances in the spiritual life, and but that maybe the other person needed that more. Like maybe the person for whom it was not for him, it might have been that he wasn't as advanced, or it might have been that patience wasn't as it wasn't as important a thing for him to be working on in the first place. I don't know, but I think that can be helpful for us coming, you know, to this group on St. Philip Neri and on the virtue of patience, because these are hard things, I think, and it can be easy to say that, I see these people doing these great things for God and get discouraged by that, but that there's often more to it than, there's often more to the reason to these things than we see. So I guess it calls for humility no matter where you're at. I mean, that's a lot more.
I sort of was thinking this one person, however, who begged him to teach it, I was wondering, is he maybe very prideful? He wants to know this method, and Philip is saying, no, it won't do for you, so there he's being taught humility, because he's really wanted to, you know, maybe he saw it as a way to,
to
make himself, you know, look better, because he could do more,
right,
more things. And
yeah, that he could then say, now I'm more of a master at the...
But it's interesting because, as you said before, this is something that was in last week's Cassian as well, the exact like instruction of this. But in the context of Cassian, this practice is assigned to the anchorites because they have to have imaginary annoying people. Because unlike the brothers in the Cenobium, they don't have any real ones. So they have to imagine all of these things to test the patience of their heart because they have no real life ways of being proven. So they could go 30 years being an anchorite. And then it gives these examples of like one person shows up and they like fly into a rage because they have no practice of patience because they have no one around.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting too, like the balance of, like if you were surrounded by people all day and that was this exercise of patience and charity all day, it probably wouldn't be very fruitful to exhaust yourself at night imagining more annoying people. You just, you know, you don't want to wear yourself out with like 12 hours of annoying people. So, you know, that might be something too, that you would only want to imagine what you you would only want to hone a virtue in that way by imagining trials you don't actually have present around you, which is interesting. Noted, of course, the one exception to any of that is with chastity, and he's like, just don't imagine anything, just pray. So, you know, just if anyone had that floating around in their head, like, that sounded weird. But it's interesting. I wonder how they practice this, actually, in the context of the oratory and in this city. Like, what could have been lacking to them in opportunities to practice that they needed to conjure up? That's interesting.
Any other thoughts about anything that we've surprisingly gotten? Is this helpful? Okay. So maybe we can start closing now then. And we don't have dessert because it's Lent. But we do have coffee, even though it's Lent. For some people, this will be a penance. For others, it will. So, why don't we go to our prayer to St. Philip Neri, if you'd like to stand. Look down from heaven, Holy Father,
from the loftiness of that mountain, to the lowliness of this valley, from that harbor of quietness and tranquility, to this calamitous sea. And now that the darkness of this world hinders no more those kindly eyes of thine from looking clearly into all things, look down and visit, O most diligent Peter, this vineyard which thy right hand planted with so much labor, anxiety, and peril. To thee then we fly, from thee we seek for aid, to thee we give our whole selves unreservedly. Thee we adopt as our patron and defender, undertake the cause of our salvation, protect thy clients. To thee we appeal as our leader, rule thine army fighting against the assaults of the devil. To thee, kindest of pilots, we give up the rudder of our loss, steer this little ship of thine, and placed as thou art on high, heal us off all the rocks of evil desires, and with thee for our pilot and guide, we may safely come to the port of eternal bliss. Amen.
And our closing hymn is, What Wondrous Love Is This?
What wondrous love is this? Oh my soul, what wondrous love is this, oh my soul, what wondrous love is this that caused the Lord of bliss to
sinking down, sinking down.
piety, I'll sing on.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Deacon Paul.